sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Export Finance Podcast. This will be the first podcast we do before our live show this year in Prague, where Simon Sayer, Gabby Buck and Simon Jones, who are all with me now, will also be joined by Anna-Karen Jetko of EKN and Thomas Baum of Euler Hermes. And our topic today, interesting one, is basically, can export finance or is export finance a force for good? And I think it's fair to say we know that what can be constituted as export finance and what's included, there's a wide spectrum. And we're not saying for a minute that everything export finance is a force for good, but I think it's fair to say that there is ways that export finance can be used in a positive way. And we'd like to have a debate on the extent to which that exists, whether it's moving in the right direction, and also whether we think we can do more and how that would look. So first question, really, and I think, you know, we need to start with an actual discussion on, you know, what do we mean by force for good? So, Gabby, perhaps you can kick us off in terms of, you know, when I say export finance is a force for good, what is it that means to you?
I think it means two things, really: transparency and terms. So if you were to look at, look at the whole market of export credit agency, I think, yes, it takes time. But there are many benefits associated with going through that process. You know, the special levels of due diligence that they undertake, you know, the qualifying certificates that provide a greater level of transparency and accountability, making sure payments are only made as and when the milestones of a contract have been fulfilled. The whole issue of sustainable lending criteria, the move by the export credit agencies of wanting to develop local currency finance. I think all of the above are issues which are good for the market as a whole. And, I think you can look at certain transactions that have happened in the market in the past. And, you know, the most iconic of bad transactions would be the Mozambican tuna loans. Would that have happened had it been done through an export credit agency? So I think that transparency, the accountability, the due diligence, I think is a very strong advocate as to what is good about export credit. And the second aspect is terms. I think they provide, particularly for the developing markets, long-term, low-cost and additional liquidity. And that must be good if you're a developing country and you want, you know, greater infrastructure and development of your nation.
Okay. And before I go to the others, just a on that point regarding Mozambique tuna loans, is your opinion that it wouldn't have happened with an ECA?
I very much doubt that that sort of transaction would have been approved by an ECA. And had it been approved, I very much doubt that the process in terms of way that the funds were dispersed would have been allowed by an export credit agency, any export credit agency.
Okay. And Simon Sayer, sort of taking Gabby's sort of general view of what's constituted as export finance for good, is that anything you would add to that?
Yeah, so I like the terms and transparency, and I think they're very good points. That for me, export credit agencies and the export finance market's always been about development. And if by a force for good we mean development in overseas markets, development of societies, development of infrastructure, then I think export finance has always been doing that. I think the recent change in the definition of force for good, we're probably going to get onto this, is around sustainable development in particular, and whether they're a force for sustainable development. And I think actually the ECAs have done a very, very good job in adapting to what society expects from an export credit agency. Could they do more? We'll talk about that as well. I think they probably could. But I think export finance generally certainly is a force for good. The social and developmental benefits of export finance are quite difficult to measure. And I think they've probably been underestimated and underrecorded, underreported as well, actually. But they're certainly there. Interestingly, we at Deutsche started about a year ago a campaign called Positive Impact at Deutsche Bank, and it was a bank-wide campaign.
It was hashtag Positive Impact.
You know it well, and it's as much an internal campaign as an external one to emphasise the positive impact of the bank and its employees in society, and it's really trying to capture, I guess, sort of utility value. But when it was launched, I was delighted because it could have been made for export finance. And we have put up so many projects into that positive impact bracket that we work on around the world that fit very, very nicely into that definition. So, look, we'll get on to whether we mean green and renewable and whether development has to be green and renewable to count. But are they a force for good in the development of the global society and infrastructure? Absolutely.
Okay. And Simon, anything to add there?
Not really. I think on the governance point, I think the way export credits is governed internally and how the agencies ensure that the money is used for the right project is something that it actually led the way, I think. And I agree with Gabby that the tuna loan undoubtedly probably wouldn't have got executed at all. What are ECAs? The word development also gives me a little bit of a problem because the ECAs are not development banks. They're not even development institutions. Well, I don't believe they are. Do they get involved in development? Yes, they do. But that's not their raison d'etre at all, and we shouldn't forget that either. So being used for a force for good is something they would hopefully aspire to do. Do they get there? Yes, they do. Have they evolved? Yes, they've evolved. And I think they're quite receptive to market changes. You saw the changes in the OECD for renewable repayments out to 18 years, which is quite some effort, really. I think force for good, it's heading in the right direction. But I would like to comment that I still don't believe them to be development institutions.
Mm-hmm. But you say it is heading in the right direction, What more could be done?
Well, I think much of the discussion is the other way. Are they going in the wrong direction in some areas? And I'm not too sure they are. I think their role is getting broader, and it should continue to move into the force for good areas that we've been talking about, the developing emerging market economies, but that's not what they were designed to do. Although that was a byproduct of what they actually do. They were designed to support exports from their home-based country. That was the only reason. And it developed because in the emerging markets 20, 30 years ago, whatever, there were no domestic local markets, bond markets. So the only way of funding these projects, if you wanted to support your exporters, was by providing support, both in terms of interest rates support and also guarantees. And I think the ECAs have just developed into a broader part of the financial community. I think they're obviously a major part of the project finance market. They're a major part of the shipping finance market. They're a major part of the aviation market. They're not only very relevant to the emerging markets. And I think that has to be remembered as well.
I completely agree. ECAs aren't developmental entities. They're there to support exporting clients. And by the way, that's our mission too. Let's be very clear about that. We're here to serve and support our clients, help them win business in markets overseas, help them have security of payment, help the buying countries finance the infrastructure that they're buying. We don't determine the sort of projects that our clients are targeting or competing for. But having said that, we are seeing more projects which you could definitely fit into that developmental bracket. I think that reflects as well the sort of geographies that we're working in. When we set out to support the bank's clients in Africa, for example, 15 years ago now, almost everything we finance in Africa is developmental by definition. And that includes what would not necessarily be defined as a renewable or sustainable project. It's just stuff that Africa needs. And that can be fossil fuel power sometimes. A lot of countries have a great dearth of energy. Last year, we financed a very large set of power stations in Egypt. They are gas-fired, combined cycle power. Huge project across three stations. Is that developmental? Absolutely developmental. You know, Egypt was going through blackouts and brownouts. There was a terrible dearth of electricity. It was a constraint on growth. And seeing those power facilities come online was hugely important for the country. They're not renewable, but what they are is they're built to the absolute top specification of the current day. The emissions controls associated with those projects are state of the art. They've been done to a very, very high standard, and they were desperately needed.
And they deliver power very, very quickly in substantial amounts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So would you do a coal-fired power station for a country that had a power shortage but had a lot of coal in their domestic market?
No, is the answer. And the bank decided about 18 months ago to stop doing that because there are much better alternatives, some of which are still fossil fuel, but it's difficult to make a coal-fired power station clean enough by today's standards and expectations.
Do you have a view on that, Gabby? Would you do it?
I think that if a country has a shortage of power, power by definition drives your economy, drives your clinics, drives your hospitals, drives your education. And if there's a choice between having no power and power which is fueled by coal, then I personally believe that, yes, we should be doing that. And I think the export credit agencies should be doing that. If there's a need to have a carbon capture aspect to that particular transaction, and that's something that the OECD and the environmentalists would want to have associated with that, then that is something that I think they and others should pay for it, not necessarily the developing country.
I think less and less that's...
I mean, it's a difficult debate. But I think at the end of the day, for a country in that developmental, force for good, having power is more important, even if it's a dirty power, than having no power at all.
Mm. Yeah, but the more technology improves and it gets cheaper to build solar farms and wind power stations, then that argument sort of lessens and lessens. And I think that was Gabby's point, 5-10 years ago, that was the argument that people were using to build coal-fired power stations in places that didn't have power. And I think there's been quite an uptick in technology improvements and cost of actually putting solar farms in, for instance. So it was very expensive and not economical at all. So as subsidies decrease into renewable and they become more commercially viable, it should filter itself out gradually.
That's an economic argument, and I get that. And I fully support if you can get cheaper power, you can get cheaper power. I think, I was wanting to debate the moral issue as to, what is force for good. I think it's very difficult to say to a country, you can't have the power station, even though you're sitting on all of the coal, even though you need all of the power. I think they need help and assistance. And I think...
I think that's a very good example, Gabby, because it's a very recent change as well, isn't it? And it's quite a recent change for my institution, but also for the OECD ECAs as well. It's a recent change. And that decision to draw the line at some point has been taken in that particular category of power. It's a fossil fuel, but not, for example, for gas. And it's all around emissions. It's very technical issues. The reason ECAs are still prepared to support gas-fired, they're still fossil fuels, they still have some emissions. Will we reach a stage where those are no longer considered acceptable by society as well? It'll be interesting to see. But at the moment, the line's been drawn at a point, and I suspect that line will move forward and forward and forward progressively over time.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue because obviously, your bank is not now sort of financing, directly financing coal, but I'm assuming you would still finance certain clients that are using coal, or maybe there's some other part of the bank that would lend a certain company money that part of what they do is related to coal, and it becomes a little bit complicated.
Yes.
But I guess that's probably where export finance is, you know, because it can be a little bit more attributable. I was wondering, but coal finance is still happening within export finance. It might not be happening within sort of certain international banks, but it is still there. And certainly if we, you know, the ECA world is wider than European ECAs, for example. I'm just wondering if coal financing is a reality, could more be done in terms of adding a certain amount of conditionality on that? That, okay, so it's a 15-year sort of coal deal, but maybe there is some agreement that is stipulated that other power sources have to be found, you know, at a point in 20 years or something like that, whether that would be an interesting way around it.
The pressure is coming from outside. You know, only quite recently, the Bank of England were urged to focus on green objectives. There was a pressure group called Positive Money, and they're putting pressure on the Bank of England not to buy bonds issued by fossil-fueled companies. And at the same time, you've got certain underwriters at Lloyd's who have announced that they're not going to be underwriting or investing in coal projects. And my sense is that the decision that those institutions are making are not ones which they would have done themselves. It's because of outside pressure groups putting that lobby onto them, and as a result, policy is being changed.
Well, I mean, let's take that point. Sort of, you mentioned Lloyd's market and private insurance, and I think private insurance is obviously an important part of export finance now as well. And I think it's fair to say that private insurance sometimes had a reputation as being able to do deals that sometimes the ECAs, for a number of reasons, are prohibited from taking part in. Do you think this is still the case? Is it changing? Or in general, are you still finding that certain deals will be covered by the private insurance market that the ECAs can no longer touch?
Yeah, I think it's bound to be the case. I think we have to define what the different roles of the private insurers and the export credit agencies. And private insurers certainly can be nimble, quicker, more flexible. And that flexibility is what differentiates them. I guess that's the differentiator mainly from the agencies, because the agencies have to support some form of export from their home base. Whereas if a private insurer is involved, they have, you know, technically they have no home base and they can cover any particular form of trade or project. But they're very different markets. The private risk insurance market is a very valuable and deep market, but it operates in the sort of, until recently, only operated really in the 2 to 7, maybe stretching to 10-year market. And with the AFIC product that Boeing and Marsh have, that's recently extended that to 12 years. But there's very little credit risk insurance goes out beyond 12 years. And the very good reason for that is that banks being insured by ECAs are being insured by governments, and understanding and feeling confident that a government is going to be there at roughly the same rating in 12 years' time is one thing. But having been through the massive crisis that we went through, understanding that an insurance company is going to be there in the same way, at the same credit rating in 12 years' time, is something completely different.
I've got an observation on that as well. You know, your question is a bit nuanced, isn't it? Are the private market insurers picking up projects that the ECAs wouldn't be prepared to support because of they wouldn't pass muster through an ECA's control process? And look, I don't think they are, but my answer is also a little bit nuanced, because I think Gabby's example of the Tuna bond transaction is a case in point. Obviously, it was a private market insured transaction. But I think the reason that market that transaction was done, it wasn't done with an export finance framework. It was done as a straight financing facility. There was an underlying use of proceeds, but not really related directly to the export of boats. And it was not done with the filters that an export finance team would impose on a transaction around use of proceeds, control of funds, how things are remitted, whether the appropriate permissions are in place, and so on. As far as I know, and I'm, you know, I wasn't part of that transaction, but that's what I understand. And I think when export finance teams use that framework working with the PRI market, then the sort of transactions that are being supported are very, very similar, if not exactly the same, to the ones the ECAs would work with. And I think it's a little bit unfair, actually, to sort of imply that the PRI market has lower standards than ECAs or prepared to be a little bit more quick and dirty in their approach. And there's another reason why it might be true that the PRI market does look at projects which ECAs don't pick up. And so Simon Jones made the point around agility and national content rules and sourcing and so on. The other reason is the private market is very, very quick to respond to improvements in credit ratings and improvements in the situation of a country, whereas ECAs may be hampered by Paris Club renegotiations or bilateral debt renegotiations, which are stopping them come back on cover for a country which otherwise has seen its credit rating improve. And the private market will step in very, very quickly and support that. And there have been quite a few examples recently, I think back to Angola 15 years ago, which was rebuilding after a civil war. And I think of Iraq more recently, which also had to rebuild after a very unpleasant war. And, you know, tremendous force for good, driven initially by the private market. And the ECAs have subsequently stepped in and become involved in that as well.
Yeah, but I think your question, Dan, is about whether the private insurance market are being used to kind of dogleg a difficult transaction that the ECAs would not cover. And I don't see that. And I don't see that for two reasons. One, I think, you know, Lloyds have a brand and reputation which they need to maintain. But also the banks. You know, the banks will look at every transaction, and whether it's covered by an ECA or whether it's covered by, you know, Lloyds of London, for them, they're still associated with that particular transaction, and they have to do their brand and reputation clearance for that particular project.
Because the project still needs the finance,
doesn't it? The project still needs the finance.
Which comes from the banks.
You still need the banks. Now, if in many ways, I think there are times when the banks will take a little bit of more of an edge on a transaction where there is an ECA providing the cover than they would do for the same transaction if there's a PRI. I think there's an element of kind of a halo effect for banks when doing a more challenging brand and reputation transaction when there's an ECA cover rather than PRI. And a great example for that is defence. You know, defence is, shall we say, the most, well, the environmental impact of a defence transaction is well understood. It's quite horrific. And the banks are willing to do those type of transactions because there is an ECA and it's a very government-to-government type transaction. I very much doubt whether those same banks would be willing to do the same transaction if it was done with just PRI, because I think they would have a weaker defence in terms of protection against any question mark on brand and reputation. So I think in many ways, ECA is better and gives a more rounded protection for banks than the PRI market.
Mm. I'm glad to. There's three different interpretations of my question. It's usually a sign of a really badly written question, so that's good. And I think it's an interesting debate, certainly within the private insurance market. This is what I've seen within sort of 10 or 5 to 10 years. I've been sort of at events where sort of one sort of say a broker has got up and said, you know, we can do some stuff that others can't do, and you know, it might not be implied as kind of to the nth degree, but then other brokers have been quite apoplectic at that. It's like, no, we're part of the same conversation. It's not an alternative. We're not filling in the cracks that ECAs can't do. It's something else, and so sort of that moves quite an interesting one to track, I think. So from one badly written question to the next one is export finance in developed markets? I mean, we've talked about sort of how export finance in developing market can be a force for good for economic change. But in developed countries, would you describe that as scope creep on the part of the ECAs?
I've got a very strong view and very clear on this. Hopefully
it's very different from ours then.
We'll see. Absolutely not. And I'm very clear about that. The ECAs are there to support their exporters. And in a properly functioning global economy, there will be trade between developed countries as well as between developed and less developed countries. It's not just north-south. It's increasingly south-south. It's north-north. Should ECAs be supporting that? Well, yes, they should. And for the very simple reason that, you know, finance can be a competitive advantage in a global marketplace and a competitive advantage for manufacturers, corporates, governments. They should have the same access to that finance, regardless of whether they're sitting in a developing market or a developed market. They're potentially competing against each other. Take the steel industry or the automobile industry. It's a global marketplace with, you know, very, very competitive manufacturers in developed markets and less developed markets. And the opportunity to finance important capex and investment should be available to both. So look, let's remember ECAs are about supporting exporters, about supporting jobs, resolving that very, very sort of basic equation of jobs versus infrastructure. And I don't think it's fair to describe it as scope creep at all. And we get back to that question. They're not development banks. They're not there for a solely developmental mission. It's part of what they do, but not everything. So
I totally agree. I think we must not forget that the export credit agencies are there to support their exporters, and they'll support their exporters wherever those exporters go. Full stop. So there's no creeping, we should only be there to support the development, the developing market. We're there to support our exporters.
And they're there too. I mean, I don't disagree with you, Simon Sayer. Scope creep, it depends how you define scope creep in your very badly worded question, Dan.
I've got many more.
But yes, scope creep can be taken two ways. I think, is the scope of ECAs, has it been expanding? Yes, it's been evolving. I'd rather call it evolving than expanding to suit the changing, ever-changing markets. And I remember saying on possibly our very first podcast a couple of years ago when we talked about business into the OECD markets covered by the ECAs and is that what they're there for? I remember saying that I did an analysis in 2002 or something at the bank I was at the time, which was a very big export credit agency bank, globally represented, and 20% of our portfolio then, even then, was into the developed world. And you've got to look at why that was. Well, aviation and shipping were big chunks of that. And you know, aviation has been supported into the developed world and shipping. Why are they supported in the developed world? Because the volumes are just so huge. And therefore, you've got that market gap creeping in sometimes. Now, there was a kind of an element of subsidy that was discussed much around the aviation sector, which has now hopefully virtually disappeared. So OECD markets don't take export credit for aircraft because it's cheaper anymore, or they shouldn't be taking it because it's cheaper. And it's not really cheaper. And I think there's adequate liquidity in the commercial markets to cover that anyway. But it's just a fact that the ECAs follow where their business should be, and you know they're following their exporters, and therefore if the big volumes are in the big projects or in the developed world, then that's where they're going to have to fill gaps. $5 to $20 billion projects use a massive amount of liquidity, and these are 15 to 20 year transactions, so that's where the market gap comes.
Okay, well I have two follow-up questions. Number one, taking your point, is there, either on the part of the ECAs or the banks financing ECA transactions, is there an opportunity cost? So if an ECA is providing a big direct loan into Dubai for a shopping mall, does that mean that money can't go somewhere else? And should it be looking to go somewhere else? Similarly, on the banking side, if you're doing sort of a, you know, if you're doing a big deal within Europe, does that mean actually you're less likely to be able to do something elsewhere? Okay. Secondly,
hang on, that's a badly worded question. So that's right. So let's just get clarity before we go on.
All right, we'll do that one first. Yeah.
Are you asking the question about capacity of an export credit agency in terms of cover
and banks?
Or you mentioned the word direct lending and direct loans. And
well, okay, so it doesn't have to be exclusive to direct lending.
Okay. Capacity wise, I don't think it does. I think there's ample capacity, and just because they do $15 billion in the USA, that's not going to stop them doing stuff in Africa or Asia or Latin America.
Totally agree.
Unanimous.
Yep. Direct lending is another issue.
Ah, that's another issue.
Okay. Right. That's the issue you're talking about, really. Because there is a finite amount of direct lending available, yeah.
And so there is an opportunity cost on the direct lending side?
Yeah.
Possibly, yeah.
I think it was... I'm trying to think the right word to describe...
you're not normally so bashful.
No, I'm just trying to be political here, but... you know, I don't think it was the best use of direct lending by UKEF on their first transaction, which was both large and for a very rich country. And I think given now with the benefit of hindsight, where that direct lending pot is not as great as it should be in terms of the demand that's been put pressure on it, I think that those direct lending allocations should be going to the more developing markets.
But just to be, polemical, it's a competitive marketplace. And when there are national contractors competing for projects in overseas markets, do you deploy your best tools to help those exporters win that business? I think you probably do.
I agree.
And so scarce resources, when there are decisions to be taken around allocation of scarce resources, then, you know, I think over time it'll become more a decision around social and developmental impact. And I think it already has, but we can't forget that export agencies are there to support their clients. I do completely agree on capacity in general, that there is plenty of capacity in the market, but for some geographies and for some regions, capacity is very tight. And I would consider, you know, the poorer rated countries of Africa or Latin America or some of the countries that most need developmental finance. And there, because of country risk constraints, capacity can be a constraint. And thinking about finance from banks, then increasingly we and others, I think, are selecting those projects which have a greater developmental impact. And would I rather finance a worthy water project in an African country over a new football stadium? Much as I love football, and we've got the World Cup coming up.
There's a big developmental angle to football.
Okay, we'll get on to that. I want to hear it. But we will choose the assets that are going to be there for many years, not just for the World Cup year, supporting the local population, making life better for people. So in those sort of unusual circumstances, I think capacity can be an issue as well.
Yeah, but the trouble is with that, and it's nice to hear that, but my sense of the market at the moment is that the banks fall into two camps, of which the majority are in the first camp, which is that they are just asset hungry for ECA-backed facilities. And, you know, they are looking to, you know, they're incentivized in terms of how big is their book. There are very few in the second camp which are looking at the quality of the transactions that they're doing. I think that qualitative aspect in terms of, being a force for good, looking at those type of transactions which have a wider developmental, and developmental can be both on the supplier side as well as on the buyer side, helping a company, move in terms of its expansion, in terms of its penetration of markets overseas.
I'd like to see the activity in your Twitter account, Gabby, after saying that.
Well,
I'm sure I'm saying is that I think banks would take an issue with that.
Well, they may do, but the fact of the matter is, when you speak to them, they're all complaining about that the total volumes are going down. They're all complaining that, you know, the big segments of shipping and aviation are down. And if you have a private discussion with some of them in the corridors, there are many who complain that they can't do defence because there's some really big defence deals that happened and, you know, they felt that they have missed out. Because they were, not that they wanted to support defence transaction, none of it. It was just they wanted ECA assets on their books.
Yeah. And there's other things that come into play as well. I mean, the dynamics around what liquidity is available in different markets is fragmented. I can remember Simon Sayer in a previous podcast talking about capacity and liquidity in certain markets was down because of regulation, KYC, AML, compliance, you name it. So doing deals in Africa, because the local regulation is a little bit, maybe in some countries, behind where the rest of the world has got to, is causing capacity issues. I think that's, and that's where the development banks should step in, not necessarily export credit agencies either, but the development banks.
So on this kind of my follow-up question, do you, and I guess it also relates to ECAs as a general rule in terms of how they're communicating either sort of to the taxpayer or to their sort of regulating authorities. There seems to be more of a push that, well, we're not losing you money. Actually, you know, we're not. And does that mean that ECAs are becoming less risk averse, particularly with sort of more challenging economies?
No.
You don't think so?
I mean, they getting access to their risk appetite is still a lengthy process. Because the DD that we were talking about earlier and the processes that they have to go through, but their risk appetite that they have for a majority of the developing markets is, I think, sufficient to support their exporters. There are, and Simon Say mentioned a few moments earlier, that there are certain markets where there's constraints or there's a huge demand for what is a scarce resource. But I think even in those markets, if push came to shove, I think the export credit agencies will find a way to accommodate those transactions.
Sometimes they do, not always. But that's okay. ECA should be risk aware. I don't think they should be risk averse. We're in an industry that's about taking measured risk and mitigants for risk. This isn't pure developmental finance. You know, you finance something and then forget about it and don't really care whether you get repaid or not. I'm a taxpayer too. Not interested in that sort of support, and they're not developmental banks. And this should be about trade and not aid, I think. You know, what ECAs in particular bring is tenor and capacity and other things. But they should, of course, always measure risk. And we do that too. Yeah.
ECAs are not expected, nor do they take risks that banks wouldn't take from a corporate credit risk perspective. The risk they take is largely political. That's what they're designed for, because lending money to a project in a certain country, as long as the project stacks up, whether you lend 5 years, 10 years or 15 years, if it stacks up from a credit risk perspective, that's fine. Banks will only lend the 5-year money uncovered, because that's what banks are designed to do. The added risk in a project in an emerging market is the political risk over time. And it's the political risk that the ECAs are there to ensure. And that actually, I think, sums up what ECAs are really there for.
Well, I think it's political and commercial on the longer tenor. I think there's a duty on banks and bankers in this industry to make sure that the projects are well structured. You know, and I think it's, you know, I look back at my career, I've never made a claim against UK Export Finance or ECGD, never made a claim. And so therefore, it's, you know, you needed the protection for events that may be outside of your control or so difficult to predict given the tenor of the facility. But it is important for us to make sure that the projects are properly structured and monitored over time. Because if I'm like Simon, I'm a taxpayer as well. And so therefore, you know, no one has any interest in seeing claims being made time in and time out to an export credit agency, because, you know, on a year-by-year basis, that's a loss. And on a term basis, that's the closure of an export credit agency. And that's in no one's interest.
Okay. On that trade versus aid issue, there has been some conversions between, you know, ECAs and then also using development agencies. There's also, less so in the UK, but in other countries, an example of some convergence between export credit and also the conditionality of aid as well. What's your view in terms of how that will continue to develop?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the UK has become a leader probably in dissociating aid from trade and trying to delink the two completely. And that's, I guess, a political decision taken by the UK government and the departments concerned. Other countries associate aid and trade very, very closely and will make conditions or attach strings to aid financing.
Sorry, do you see that as a good thing or a bad thing?
I think in my heart of hearts, I see it as a bit of a bad thing.
Oh, good. Yeah, because I think it's a bad thing.
I think in a globally competitive marketplace, the first one that disarms is quite often at a disadvantage, and I think that's probably what's happened to UK exporters as a result. And more savvy countries, savvy or commercially, you can see this both ways, are do attach conditions to trade. But you know what? That can be so powerful sometimes as well, because it can quite often be the key that unlocks a financing package or financing plan for a particular project. And we worked on something last year, which is a transaction which it's a water project in Africa. It includes a state aid facility from France. It includes a COFAS BPI-backed export credit. And by far the largest component is a privately supported, privately insured commercial facility. You know, three separate tranches all financing the same project. And the thing that unlocked the whole set was the relatively small aid facility. And it was important because many borrowers, carefully monitoring their debt obligations, are looking for concessionality in the overall financing package. And sometimes the aid component can be an important part in making those concessionality equations work.
Well, for certain markets, unless the overall financing is deemed to be concessional, then unless it's concessional, then the buyer borrower can't undertake that project.
Exactly.
And that seems to be lost on the UK government. And so if you're a UK exporter and you're trying to do social infrastructure, good projects in developing markets, or to countries which have a constraint with the IMF in terms of can only raise debt on a concessional basis, then if you're just a UK exporter, then I'm afraid, unless something changes, you have no hope of winning.
So you have to be creative and do, as Simon described, which is quite interesting, that the you get someone else to bring in the aid components. There are development institutions that can do that.
Yeah, but then, you know, dream on, Simon. I mean, at the end of the day, another country, look at China, for example. Why is China, you have to ask yourself, why is China so successful in sub-Saharan Africa? Why do other nations within the OECD provide both the export credit and a tied aid, which is making the overall financing deemed to be concessional, so successful? And the reason, because they bring the two together. And let's be very clear, this is not aid that's going to the exporter as a way of subsidizing their contract price. This is an interest makeup to make the overall debt facility deemed to be concessional under the IMF rules. So if you're a Mr. Sovereign that have these constraints and an exporter from Europe or an exporter from outside of the UK or from China come along with a package that has the commercial and the financing with the aid, they're good to go. And those transactions happen very quickly. And if you're a UK exporter, you're out. And UK exporters have been shouting about this. There's been, you know, British Exporters Association have been providing inputs to various reviews that have been ongoing, but nothing happens here. And it's, for some reason, the UK government have, in their infinite wisdom, come up with their own rules saying that you can't mix trade with aid. And in reality, they're the only ones who come up with this rule. And it's an internal rule that we've self-imposed. And, you know, look at the bigger picture. Look at UK Export Finance. They did 3 billion sterling of supporting exporters last year. Great. Well done. Look at DFID. They spent 13 billion pounds last year. Now, by definition, that 13 billion pounds last year wasn't linked to UK goods and services. I'm a taxpayer. We've got the biggest trade deficit since records began. And if we carry on of having this in self-imposed rule, which is detrimental to UK exporters, then let's just watch this trade deficit get bigger and bigger and look at our power across, soft power and hard power across Africa will diminish because they, you know, their hands are held. And so therefore, you know, my viewpoint is this has to change. Otherwise, UK exporters will lose out time in and time out.
Look, I agree with what you're saying, Gabby, but I'm a bit less interested in hard and soft power. I don't feel comfortable with the concept of UK and sort of saying this is all about power, which I don't think it is. But I do link it back to the developmental aspect, which is if you're going to deploy developmental finance, then do so in a way that at the same time benefits the taxpayers who are paying for that developmental finance. So, you know, associate it with a commercial financing package in order to get that project secured for whoever your exporting champions are.
So isn't the way forward to devise a structure for determining value for money for the contract? Because isn't that what it's about, that if you link trade with aid, you can give a very cost-ineffective project and build it up just because you're getting the aid, and therefore there's lots of room for corruption and all sorts of things in there. So if you have value for money in the contract, why wouldn't you have aid and trade together?
Because it's not that. Simon, it's a very mathematical formula that the buying government has to warrant to the IMF and to the World Bank that the financing package that they have taken on meets the 35% grant concessionality.
I know that. That's not what I'm saying. The other side of it.
But that's at its nub. That is the crux of the problem.
Yeah, and you can do that. The UK government can do that.
No, they can't.
They've got aid. Okay, forget the rules. They could do that if they wanted to.
And
they can give the 35% grant element, whatever. But the reason I understood that the UK government didn't want to do that was because, perception-wise, you only give your aid, oh, you have to buy my kit. But you have to buy my kit not necessarily from a... You know, it's the economic impact of buying that kit. Are you paying too much for that kit?
And if you think about it, UKEF still will, even if you've got a grant element to get the interest rate reduced to make it concessional, UKEF will still need to go through the sustainable lending criteria and value for money criteria. That doesn't change. It's just that you make the financing concessional under the IMF terms. And it's a very black and white, does it fit, does it not fit? Yeah. And if it doesn't fit, sorry, Mr. UK exporter, you're not going to win on this one. But, you know, come along, Mr. French, come along, the Germans, come along, the Dutch, come along, the Chinese, you got a deal.
Sorry, can I ask, Simon, on your deal in Africa, where it was French support from the development side and the ECA side, what was the level of communication between the actual sort of the French institutions on that? Was there a level of coordination? Was it seamless?
So it was heavily coordinated, inter-creditor agreements, very carefully conducted. Certainly on the two French sides, so the two French components, the COFAS BPI side and the state aid side, the private sector tranche a little bit less so, but not much. Yeah, had to be very carefully orchestrated. Lovely project. It was in Kenya, by the way, 180 million for a dam for sustainable water, no power, just water management and water supply to communities that otherwise wouldn't have had it. So, you know, lovely example. But really, you know, to Gabby's point around the concessionality equations, it was that aid component, fairly small. You know, it was a relatively small part of the overall. Was key just to unlocking the whole thing.
Let me guess, did you do it in euros?
Yes.
Yeah. And actually, the reason I asked that question, although a bit flippant, when you look at the euro, sir, and you look at the level of grant that provides, it's around 25%. To get to 35%, the point that Simon's making is that it's a very small element that needs to be created for that interest makeup to make it concessional. So you can move a project forward with very small amounts of aid.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do wonder in the UK example if... you know, I understand why there's a reluctance to sort of foregoing the independence of aid You know, it is a philosophical argument, but what seems to be the challenge in the UK also is there's a real sort of lack of coordination, even communication between, say, DFID and other government. I mean, literally, people do not really know what DFID are doing. There's not that much level of transparency in information.
And Dan, I have to say, I think it's more than that. Actually, I don't think they actually want to know in this case, because ideologically it is so separated from trade that they're not interested.
Okay. Yeah. Well, moving on. So, does an increased number of Equator Principle compliant or SDG compliant deals, which we seem to be seeing, mean potentially a larger breadth of secondary market investors or liquidity partners that could be interested in sort of involving themselves in ECA assets? So, you know, if you were a pension fund that was looking for something that had a green component, and there are an increasing number of ECA deals where there is that green component, does that mean that, you know, there's an element of ECA finance that could market itself for that kind of secondary market investor?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, there is the answer. Investors are attracted to the trade asset class generally, and to infrastructure in particular. And why infrastructure? Because it's long-dated assets which provide regular annuity income, which suits pension funds. We know that. But for Equator Principle compliant or Sustainable Development Goal compliant projects, there are even more opportunities. Because I think all pension funds would like to do more of that. And some have actively said, not only will we do that, but we'll give preferential terms or preferential support for that as well. And for example, there's a coalition of Dutch and Scandinavian pension investors who set up in 2016 a sort of pledge between them to target investable solutions around the UN Sustainable Development Goals. You know, great example. Green bonds are another. A number of banks have issued green bonds. Investors love them. It's become quite trendy, but also worthy.
And I mean, the reason why that's happening is because these pension funds, if you look behind the scenes, and the banks have also signed up to certain goals. And so internally, they're going to have some objective in their, they've agreed with their shareholders that, you know, by 2020, 2025, whatever, they're going to have facilitated or been involved in X hundred billion dollars worth of, you know, sustainable finance and subscription as well. So it's built into the whole infrastructure of institutions now. It's the way forward.
I think there's a real opportunity here for ECAs to reposition themselves a little bit in this market. And I'm part of the Export Finance Forum of the ICC. And one of the members, this is Paul Richards at ANZ, has been very vocal, helpfully vocal, in suggesting that the ECAs take an opportunity to reposition themselves around the Sustainable Development Goals of the United Nations, which were launched in 2015. And the Export Finance Forum of the ICC has set up a sustainability working group to engage with export credit agencies, those that are interested, around that opportunity to reposition a little bit around development goals and the, you know, the many, many knock-on benefits of ECA support that we've been discussing. Great initiative. So we'll see. Because what we haven't been very good at doing, although we've been doing these projects, I just mentioned one, I don't think anybody has systematically kept statistics around how many projects have been green projects, which ones are renewable, which are sustainable. You know, we keep many statistics in banking. You know, I've got records going back as long as my career on what sort of deals we've done and where, but I've never split out, and nor has my institution asked me to date, which ones we would describe as developmental and which ones we wouldn't. It's just never been a question. And if that changes and people start to measure it, you know what? As soon as you have measurements and targets, then behaviour changes
too. Because at the moment, banks are only assessed in terms of how big is my book. And the point about, and you mentioned earlier about positive impact, and you have I suspect, Simon, saying to you, your positive impact of transactions that you do in any one year must be X amount of your total portfolio.
And you're absolutely right. And it's a, you know, it's a kind of a side thing, and it's nice to have.
But that will filter down. That will filter down to your level, because the thing I described earlier about the banks committing to their shareholders, that 200 billion is then got to be shared amongst all the different divisions of the bank. And so you will get that eventually. Yeah. You will have to do something up to whatever billion.
Is there a methodology in place that you could use or will begin to use?
What, as the definition of what is the definition of
track,
green?
Yeah. Well,
I've got an idea, a TXF idea.
The
TXF green league table.
A league table.
Or a green index, I was thinking. Yeah, I think it's down to you, Dan, really.
A green index. Green index, yeah.
There will need to be a sort of an independent agreement on what is a developmental project and what isn't, because one person's development is somebody else's force for bad. And look, let me just come back to my Egypt example. There's four of us sitting around this table. Who thinks that's developmental? It's a great podcast, but four hands have gone up. So we all think that's developmental, but it's clearly not renewable. It's not sustainable.
No, which brings me on to a point that what is deemed environmentally friendly. So diesel-powered ships are now being powered with LNG power. In many institutions, that deemed to be a very positive, and that would count to be financed under a green bond, for instance, because it's better than what was there before. And that benchmark will move, obviously.
Listen, one of the largest exporters of coal country issued in February this year a green bond. And, you know, it's for $1.25 billion.
Which country?
Indonesia. Right. What defined it as being green was third-party consultants who were paid to verify that that bond was a green bond. There's no tracking as to what that green bond, the funds of that green bond, will be used for. Just a green bond.
That's interesting, because I think there are measures in place these days to track use of proceeds under bonds as well. It's nothing like as clearly defined as it is in our export finance world, where the use of proceeds is absolutely nailed down. But there are mechanisms, so I'm surprised to hear that.
What it shows that there are investors who are going to be attracted to something that has been defined as being green. Going back to Dan's first part of this question is, will that create more liquidity for ECA assets in the secondary market? I think it will at a later point in time. But today, my viewpoint is that those green investors, the yield that they're looking for anything that is long-term, as Simon Sohn was saying earlier, that's well-structured and the risk properly mitigated, their yield aspirations as green investors is much, much higher than these assets are trading between financial institutions at this moment in time.
And one issue, one sort of dichotomy you've got is that renewable energy, by its very nature, needs long-term debt, but green bonds, by their very nature, have not been long-dated. They're 3 to 5 years.
And moving forward on that, so, I mean, when you talk about this potential opportunity of encouraging green investors, is this something exclusively for export credit agencies that sign up to the OECD consensus? Is it OECD consensus related, or do you think it could be something that's wider?
Well, I think export credit agencies are there to support their exporters. The OECD consensus is a guideline, it's not a rule book. Even if the OECD starts to relax its guidelines on what is green and what is not green, competitive forces will kick in, and an export credit agency will do what it can within the risk parameters to support that particular client. So if it's in renewable energy, it will still do 17, 18-year repayment periods.
Yeah. But I think people's mission statements, whether it's investors, banks, ECAs, governments, everyone's version of their mission statements will gradually increase the, you know, the sustainable, renewable-type agenda. And I think the motor's rolling now. I mean, the snowball is getting bigger and bigger.
Gradually. Well, look, I represent a company that is in the renewable off-grid power. And there is no shortage of interest by financial institutions for those type of projects where there's an ECA backed. You know, they all want that asset to fit their criteria of, you know, their renewable energy green aspirations. So the liquidity is already there. People are very much interested in these type of transactions. But I don't see them pricing it differently.
Yeah, I don't either. I agree with that. There's a preference for the underlying asset class, but people at the end of the day still want yield.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm glad you mentioned that or accepted that, because herein lies the crux of this whole podcast. Everybody likes to fit these type of assets into their kind of PR bucket. But in reality, people are just doing the same type of business. It doesn't matter what it's this sector, that sector, that sector.
Well, people are trying to have their cake and eat it, aren't they? I think people will try to show a preference for deals that fit their environmental and sustainable goals, their mission statements, providing they still provide the yield that they need. You know, it's those two things together.
Yeah,
spot on.
Yeah, I guess my point with regard to the OECD consensus is, from an investor standpoint, what you have there is a framework, and I guess framework leads to consistency, and consistency makes something more easy to understand as, say, a potential asset or whatever. The increasing grayness to which the OECD consensus is currently upheld would be counter to that, which you could make an argument: if the OECD consensus is becoming more gray, that makes export finance less easy to understand, which means all this opportunity for investors to come in, it might not happen.
My viewpoint on investors, they are only interested in the quality of the guarantee of the underlying transaction and in the quality of the agent bank. I'm talking about non-bank investors, and the quality of the agent bank to manage that facility and making sure that the guarantee is intra vires all the way through.
I think the OECD, Dan, is not that grey around the common approaches on, you know, environmental and social issues. The framework that the OECD set up a few years ago, was it 2012, I think, around the common approaches, I think it's pretty clear, actually. I don't think it's grey. I know where you're coming from. I think there's been a lot of invention around the edges of what ECAs do today, which sit probably a little bit outside the consensus. Some of the direct lending programs, national content rules, third country, local financing, all of those things are the areas where there has been some interpretation and flexibility in new products. But actually around the common approaches on those core issues of what's environmentally acceptable under the common approaches, I think it's been pretty rigorously applied, my personal opinion.
Yeah. And there's not a gap in the availability of liquidity for ESG assets either. So when the bank liquidity goes down, there's enough alternative investor appetite out there for it. So I don't think it's an issue. And I think the framework is a kind of good framework that investors think, yep, okay, that's OECD ECA, I understand it.
Okay. And do you expect it will become more difficult? I mean, we've spoken about coal already, but do you think it'd be more difficult to conduct deals that have negative environmental repercussions or developmental repercussions? And is this ECA bank driven? Is this regulation driven, reputation driven?
All the above. Mm. Yeah, for sure. And to the extent that there are technological solutions to complex problems, people will now expect them to be included in the project. And people will expect things to be done to a high standard, which meet environmental and sustainability goals. You know, if there's a NOx emissions control unit, you've got to fit it. You know, there won't be shortcuts. And that, I think, is a good thing. And I think the banks, the ECAs, are all broadly moving forward in the same way. I'd just like to come back to Gabby's point right at the very beginning of the podcast around transparency, because that implied other issues more than just social and environmental ones. And here, I think actually the banks have become more sensitive to reputational risk issues than probably the OECD ECAs have. And I'm thinking about the KYC issues faced by banks, anti-bribery and corruption, and anti-money laundering, anti-financial crime, terrorist financing activities, all of those things which banks have to screen for very, very diligently these days are probably not as high on the ECA agenda as environmental and social implications have been. And those are every bit as important for reputational risks as are the environmental and sustainability goals.
That's interesting because I agree with you, other than in my previous employer when I was running the export credit agency business there, brand and reputation risk approval would have to go first before we were even able to secure a mandate with a particular exporter or with a particular buyer, or before we even had any support from the export credit agency. And the reason being is that the viewpoint that that institution took, which I fully agree with, is that reputational risk is with you forever. So you may do a transaction that may be, you know, a five-year financing facility, but if something goes from a reputational risk perspective, that still could go wrong, so to speak, 10, 15 years later.
You're not thinking of any particular deals there, are you, Gabby?
The deals that you've all been associated with in one form or another. Right. But, yeah, there's many a case study. I mean, you know, chances are 20 years from now, we'll be talking about the Mozambique, well, if we're still alive, we'll be talking about the Mozambique tuna loans as being a bad reputational risk transaction.
Disaster.
So the point I'm making, it's not a credit risk issue, and it's not a time, you know, it's not a time defined risk. It's a risk of your name being associated with that transaction, and even after the last repayment may have come in, something may come out of the woodwork that the bank may not be aware of that creates the reputational risk.
Completely agree. Yeah,
and banks, I think now across the market as a whole, are looking at this much more seriously than they have done in the past.
And, you know, common approaches across the OECD ECAs is fairly recent. It's been updated. It was updated 2 years ago, 2016. The last piece of OECD guidance on bribery and corruption, for example, was 2006, 12 years ago. So, the adaptation to the current requirements of the market has not kept pace on that side of things, I think. That's a good point.
You might wish you hadn't mentioned that.
No, I don't think so. No, I don't. Really important that the market moves forward together. No, on the contrary.
How do you square the challenge of financing projects in less developed countries with the risk of adding debt to those countries that already are deemed to be highly indebted?
I'd like to start with this because I think this is really topical. You know, next week I'm going to be moderating and chairing a session at University of Cambridge just on this issue.
Humble brag.
Yeah, humble brag. But I think it's interesting that it's now moved from the financing market to the NGOs to academia who are looking at how do you provide that need to fulfill infrastructure requirements into Africa, and where I am next week is about Africa, whilst at the same time making sure that you don't create a debt level that hinders the growth of the country or adversely impacts the economic well-being of each person in that country.
It's damned if you do and damned if you don't, isn't it? And that this is another definition of what's sustainable, isn't it? It's what's a sustainable debt level, because a lot of this stuff can't be bought as a cash purchase, clearly, but it, very, very important to manage sustainable debt levels. And, you know, it should not be a barrier for either commercial finance or developmental aid finance, in my opinion. Countries have to be allowed to progress. But I think that the measures and checks and balances that you put in place, like debt sustainability measures for the HIPC countries and value for money measures, budget prioritization, nobody wants to see the IMF involved in everything, but they have a very rigorous process around this, which gives great amount of comfort to lenders when they're looking at countries that what is being planned will be sustainable, carefully controlled and prioritized as well. And more discipline required probably without the IMF's help. And then what I came back to too around selecting very carefully the projects that are chosen, and, you know, probably a football stadium is not a great example, but a water project is.
Yeah, and I think actually this is where the ECAs will come to their fore, because if you are a country that needs infrastructure, you know, what as Simon Jones was saying earlier, in terms of where is the liquidity of funding, and in essence, it's ECA, bank or bond. Now, the benefit of an export credit agency is that it's low cost, it provides additional liquidity, there's no cost of carry during the drawdown period. You know, funds are only dispersed as when milestones have been reached. The agency, the export credit agencies are, in my opinion, cognizant of the role and responsibility that they have. And so therefore, they're pushing longer tenors out. That is important to make the transaction affordable to, you know, Joe Public in the street. They also are developing, some faster than others, in terms of local currency export credit agency financing, which I think is a very important facet to make these projects sustainable on a long-term basis. And, you know, and there's one or two who are still looking at correlating the debt to commodity. So therefore, there's a natural hedge for a developing market having long-term debt, which is associated or linked in terms of the price of that debt to their commodity. And that, I think, is development which the agencies are looking at, which has not been seen in the bank and the bond market. And I think that is a very good example of force for good.
Linking prices to commodity, linking debt to commodity and therefore the sustainability of affording that debt is one thing. And that's, we raised this last time on the podcast, and I think you were very supportive of euro financing to get the
concessionality
in the transaction. But most of the countries that have commodities are linked to dollars, and I think that I'm still struggling a little bit with the massive increase in euro debt taken by emerging markets of commodity-producing countries over 15, 20 years.
But here's the dilemma. I get
what's the sustainability of that?
Yeah, I get the point. But here's the dilemma. You're a government. You've only got 2% of your population that is linked to the grid for electricity. And that's hampering your economic growth. It's hampering your ability to educate and move your country forward. You've got two choices. One, you could do dollar debt, but you're never going to get it through the IMF concessionality. So therefore, the project doesn't happen. Or you do it in euros. Going back to the Simon Sayers point, small amount of aid makes it concessional. And you can then provide power to the populace. So you're a politician, and you've got that dilemma.
Yep.
Guess what? Yep. You're not going to go down the dollar route.
I know.
That's fact of life.
But I'm just surprised at the level of acceptability of this to the ECAs. I mean, I can remember times, and you'll remember them, when, you know, countries were trying to borrow Swissies and yen because there were negative interest rates, and it was outlawed completely because there was no hedge whatsoever.
It was never outlawed.
It wasn't.
It was frowned upon. I don't think there's a law against it, but I
can. There's a law against it, but you wouldn't allow it for a sustainability perspective. Yeah, and today, it's actually, if you go into the aircraft market, ECA aircraft market, if assets are valued in dollars. If an airline wants to borrow euros because it's cheaper, they can only borrow euros under the ECA programs if they can show there's a natural hedge within their portfolio. And Egypt hasn't. And it's borrowed $5 billion worth of euros worth of 15, 16, 17 year debt. And its revenue streams are almost exclusively linked to the US dollar.
Wow, poor Simon, you're just long on dollars.
No, it's not a Simon Dollar issue. It's not. It sounds like that, I know.
It does.
No, I think it's a it's not a big issue because it's not happening. You know, we're not talking about hundreds and hundreds of billions, but it's...
Well, you know, with interest rates and dollars going with the way they are up, versus euro,
mm-hmm.
I don't think this is just going to be a...
But we're talking 15 years. We're not talking what's happening in the next five.
Well, just look at the, you know, look at the forward yield curve on dollars versus euro. It's
I think this argument would have more substance if you were talking about countries that didn't have hard currency receipts. And you know, I think as soon as you're talking about a country which has hard currency receipts, then the convertibility of that hard currency into another hard currency is, yeah, in the scheme of things, a fairly small concern. I would agree with you that financing hard currency denominated, be it euro or dollar, for a country that has no hard currency receipts, that's problematic.
Yeah.
So good point, but euro dollars, I'm not sure that's quite so important.
Okay, Mr. Euro.
Final question. Do you have a prediction on the shape of the export finance as a force for good within the next 5 years' time? Where will we get to? Where should we get to? Who would like to go first? Gabby's going first.
I think it will grow. I think there will... It's, but I think the pressure... to that growth will come from third parties. I don't think it's going to be the banks. I don't think it's going to be the export credit agencies. I think it's going to be the stakeholders of the banks. It's going to be the stakeholders of the export credit agencies. It's going to be the investors who, and we've been talking about this for the last half hour now, where the KPIs for those institutions are going to be changed as a result of these factors, the market will move.
Yeah, the direction of travel is very clearly established, isn't it? And this will become more and more important. Could I be tempted into making some predictions? So do I think that ECAs will drop out of fossil fuel financing completely in 5 years? Not really. I think there's still too much at stake and there aren't as many freely available alternatives for every single market that would make that possible. But could ECAs drop out of aircraft financing, for example, which, you know, a lot of people have been pointing at aircraft, international travel and so on as a negative effect on the climate. I think that's certainly a possibility. It's kind of a negative force for good, if you know what I mean. It's becoming a force for good, but in a negative way. But clearly there's going to be more preference, both by banks, by ECAs, by the private market, to get involved in projects which have a sustainably acceptable framework around them.
I don't think the ECAs will pull out of aviation finance, and of course...
Well, hang on, one of them has.
I don't think ECAs will pull out of, as a generalisation, out of aviation finance. And I think ECAs will continue to be involved. And don't forget that aircraft are forever changing their technology. They're lighter, they're more fuel efficient. So the evolving efficiency of aircraft, stop it, Gabby, is there to be seen. But I think the ball is rolling. And for the reasons we've just mentioned, you know, NGOs, corporate shareholders will ensure that sustainability just becomes an increasing agenda item. And ECAs will have to just fall into line as well, as they have done. They've continued to evolve, and they will do so.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. We will see you all in Prague on the 5th, 6th and 7th June. I assume from what you're saying, Simon Sayer, you'll be taking the train. Simon Jones, you'll be flying.
I'll be cycling.
Gabby be cycling. All right. Well, thank you very much.
I might be late.
Thanks very much, everyone, and see you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cheers. Bye.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life.